Thank you for spending your afternoon with me, or allowing me to spend my afternoon with you. I'm honored to be here, part of the Yom Kippur proceedings. I don't want to spend too much time on prepared comments. I don't want to bore everybody to death, so I'll speak for a little while, and then hopefully we'll have room for questions or comments. And if there's anything that you would like me to address that you haven't heard from me, then I'm happy to answer it as best I can. I want to thank particularly Rabbi Brant Rosen for inviting me. I have to confess that I'm a little bit of a hermit these days. I kind of sit at home and don't venture out very frequently, and so I'm a little bit nervous. This has been a while since I've done this sort of thing, speaking publicly, but I couldn't turn down the opportunity to be here in this space and to learn more about the high holidays, and just to be in the presence of so many people in Chicago that I love and admire. And so it's a great honor, and I'll do my best to I hope raise some points that you'll find provocative or interesting, and we'll take it from there. During the summer of 2016, thousands of people representing dozens of nations converged on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in the American state currently known as South Dakota. They arrived to prevent the destruction of land and water by a foreign oil company, Energy Transfer Partners of Dallas, a regular in the Fortune 500, was constructing an underground pipeline to deliver crude oil from near the Canadian border to southern Illinois, where it would connect to extant transportation infrastructure to the Gulf of Mexico. The convergence at Standing Rock, a nation existentially threatened by the pipeline, earned the world's attention and became an extraordinary site of multinational organizing. The Palestinian black, red, and green could be seen in the spectrum of colors. While corporate media focused on environmental impact, indigenous leaders, following the example of their Lakota and Dakota hosts, discussed the pipeline as a byproduct of colonization. Poisoned water wasn't its only danger. The pipeline was scheduled to run beneath land various nations still claim, either through treaties or ancestral habitation, or both. Native leaders estimated that it would impact nearly 400 archaeological sites and desecrate dozens of sacred places along its route, including graveyards. From the federal government's point of view, the project also had the benefit of erasing our footprint in the world, in the words of LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, the historical preservation officer at Standing Rock. The Sioux and their brethren set up Sacred Stone Camp to ensure their survival, and by extension, that of the world at large, a sentiment consecrated in the slogan, "Water is life." Although the Obama administration halted construction pending further review of the pipeline's environmental impact, upon taking office, Trump swiftly issued an executive order allowing the project to continue. Within 6 months of its completion, six different spills were recorded. The largest spill, near the southern terminus, dumped 168 gallons into the environment. Energy Transfer Partners declined to report a November 2017 spill in Iowa to relevant authorities. Many of the water protectors faced felony charges. The U.S. federal government continues to ignore hundreds of treaty obligations. In my last book, I explored solidarity across borders through what I call internationalism, and there's a backslash between inter and nationalism. It's a really annoying word to have to read, or to speak, I should say. I want to revive that formulation, and let me give the short definition. Concurrent struggles for national liberation that share important features and are subjugated by a mutual power. These communities, in turn, have good reasons to work together. When they do it, they are engaging internationalism, or mutually affirming national struggles whose destinies are bound together. For many reasons, natives and Palestinians are perfectly suited to an international relationship. The U.S. and Israel are more than mere allies. They are symbiotic practitioners of settler colonization. Each inhabits the other's economy and consciousness. and both are convinced, or try to convince everybody else, that they're doing God's work in the world. Plenty of Native activists and writers are aware of these connections. Their uses of Palestine in discourses and images reveal a wide range of international possibilities. For those raised in the United States, it can be difficult to comprehend Native politics. Non-Native people rarely discuss those politics, first of all. And the country's peculiar romance with assimilation as the solution to racism further hinders comprehension. It's impossible to cover the range and complexity of Native politics in one afternoon, but we can correct some misperceptions. The most critical thing to understand is that Natives don't seek civil rights, or they're not limited to civil rights anyway. They're engaged in national liberation struggles. The difference is significant. While the politics of assimilation can appear innocuous, they're not innocuous, by the way, they don't apply to Black and Native Americans, the former descending from captive populations and the latter having no immigrant origin. For Natives, assimilation is a form of genocide. The pursuit of civil rights would bring them no closer to autonomy or self-determination. Sovereignty, a concept that has its origin in treaty obligations, is a limited commodity, often subject to federal oversight or corporate ambition. Different tribal nations use different approaches. On the whole, though, emphasis in Indian country is on restoring nationhood, something that entails tribal control of legal and political systems and stewardship over the land, including fauna, minerals, and urban development. The sensibility is less about getting a seat at the table than it is repossessing the table from the interlopers, using it to gorge themselves. Natives probably know better than anybody else how difficult outsiders can be. Prospectors, missionaries, anthropologists, soldiers, New Agers, businessmen, imposters, spies, developers, shamans, all bring little more than trouble. And yet Native intellectual traditions remain amenable to reciprocity, maintaining an old spirit of exchange and hospitality. Much of the earth registers in the study of indigeneity. Palestinians have been a source of significant interest. People converged at Standing Rock to demand an end to foreign occupation, but water was, and continues to be, the material resource that would ensure freedom. The Lakota and Dakota underscored the incompatibility of water and oil. By speaking of the need to protect their primary sustenance and thus preserve their future, they delivered wisdom to everyone trying to survive the ravages of capitalism. Actively protecting water, rather than merely condemning the cultivation of oil, is a visionary project both for liberation and ecological livelihood. As nations gathered at Standing Rock, the mostly Black residents of Flint, Michigan, were experiencing a lead contamination in their drinking water, a problem that still hasn't been resolved. Many First Nations in Canada endure similar kinds of pollution. In South Asia and Latin America, poor communities have little access to water at all, much less to clean water. All the while, corporations tap into public reservoirs at little cost while turning out billion-dollar profits. Nestle owns over 100 bottling factories in 34 countries. In 2017, the State Water Resources Control Board of California found that the company had been diverting water from the San Bernardino National Forest. In 2016, Egyptian health officials concluded that Nestle, Aquafina, and Baraka had produced spring water, unfit for human consumption. Potable water increasingly is a privatized luxury. Water is life. An essential resource for survival, then, is in the hands of people who consider our well-being an obstacle. Destruction of water sources is yet another ill Natives share with Palestinians, who have long suffered privation as a result of their colonizers' unquenchable appetite. It made sense for Palestinians in North America to show up at the Sacred Stone Camp because they understand the need to defend the wretched against state and corporate aggression. For Natives inclined to sympathy with Palestine, the arrival of Palestinians added another anti-colonial imprimatur to a struggle that mainstream commentators were intent on reducing to a tragic misunderstanding or an irritant that could go away with a bit of presidential altruism. Politicians and opportunists make it a point to avoid the Palestinian flag. Many of the people in the Sacred Stone camp, then, bore the particular kind of empathy arising from experience. The ability to relate beyond the limits of rhetoric is a seminal feature of internationalism. We have few opportunities in industrialized society to take on another group's pain and thus become invested in its liberation. The ruling class prefers to keep us in violent competition over diminishing resources. Standing Rock is a terrific site of resistance because it aims to keep those resources at home. By hosting indigenous communities from the Pacific to West Asia, the Sacred Stone Camp has been a model of decolonial praxis, despite the many tensions in evidence whenever large crowds gather. It achieved this stature through a simple but unwavering demand. Leave the glossy sources of human progress in the ground, where they belong. Public lands, already stolen from natives, can be subject to ongoing theft for the benefit of corporations and their clients in Washington. In February 2018, the Trump administration cut the size of Utah's Bears Ears National Monument by 85% and nearby Grand Staircase Escalante in half. These sites belong to the Ute, Hopi, Zuni, and Diné nations, who have used them for millennia to cultivate food and medicine. Bears Ears has over 100,000 archaeological sites, some dating to 12,000 BCE. The government intends to cut the size of 25 more national monuments. According to the Department of Interior documents obtained by the New York Times and subsequently posted online, the parks contain significant oil, gas, and coal deposits. The Utah Geological Survey estimates that Bears Ears has over 11 billion tons of accessible coal deposits and 550 barrels of oil held in tar sand deposits, all between worth $2 billion and $18.6 billion. Timber is another exploitable resource. Although a broad coalition is working to preserve the monuments, they'll soon become repositories of private wealth. In the U.S., these conflagrations rarely have another outcome. The complexity of U.S. statecraft is constantly simplified by increased production of lucrative commodities. There's little sense of common good in the United States. Land exists to be developed. Technology solves the same problems it creates. Resources must be used to power modernity. Profit justifies process. Each mythology arose in relation to the dispossession of native peoples. It is therefore axiomatic that natives are rendered invisible by the prominence of each mythology. Standing Rock is important because it demands that indigenous peoples determine their own destinies rather than existing as bystanders to calamitous ideals of progress. Battling oil companies and trying to preserve the natural world absent of decolonization is bound to produce little more than spectacle. Much of the activism around the shrinkage of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante urges the government to keep the land under federal protection. While this approach is important as an immediate remedy to the problem, it is limited as a long-term politics. Rather than invoking natives as a reason for preserving national monuments, it is more appropriate to seek restoration of the land to native control. Land, not law, is the stable entity in this situation. In other words, colonial logic asks us to process the issue of conservation through juridical perspectives. And lots of people consent, inspired in no small part by the exalted status of law as the basis of just rule. The logic leads its purveyors to bureaucratic notions of salvation. But we know that laws can change through legislative maneuvering or by fiat of presidential caprice. Laws can also be ignored. They act in the social good only insofar as they exist on paper. These are remarkably mercurial things on which to base a civilization. A politics that centers land is less mechanical and is capable of producing more sustainable outcomes. Let's return to Bears Ears and Grand Staircase. The monuments are shrinking, but the land that comprises them is not. Conservation in the hands of U.S. jurisprudence will always be susceptible to political expedience. We must therefore seek to preserve the actual environment rather than the statutes by which it is interpolated. The land will be irrevocably altered not because the U.S. government made a mistake, but because it was under control of the U.S. government in the first place. The water protectors at Standing Rock consistently articulate this principle. They are uninterested in submitting their well-being to the good graces of their colonizer. The ultimate goal, even as they pursue short-term remedies, is to decide the fate of the water and the land it traverses so that it may continue to sustain life rather than symbolize destruction. Then there is Israel's involvement in these colonial systems. We can obliquely connect Israel to Standing Rock. The private security firm G4S, which long patrolled the West Bank, BDS kicked it out a year or two ago, but I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that it's back. The G4S also worked the beat in South Dakota. Israel's presence is more strongly felt elsewhere, though. The visuals of the Sacred Stone Camp and its militarized surroundings evoked a familiar distress among Jews and Palestinians. A skirmish broke out in media specializing in the Middle East about how the situation at Standing Rock most appropriately relates to Palestine-Israel. And we've all seen those arguments before in millions of other contexts. This is what Israel resembles. This is what Palestine resembles. This speaks to us. This speaks to us. In this case, the Zionists lost the argument because they were too invested in top-down authority to provide any convincing arguments. Private security firms also paid attention to the visuals. Tiger Swan, one such mercenary outfit, and I'm reading from an Intercept article, targeted the movement opposed to the Dakota Access Pipeline with military-style counterterrorism measures, collaborating closely with police in at least five states. One of the firm's reports from September 2016 declares that, and I'm reading from the report, the presence of additional Palestinians in the camp and the movement's involvement with Islamic individuals is a dynamic that requires further examination. Whatever natives and Palestinians may believe about one another, the state and its corporate goons understand the great danger that arises whenever oppressed people get together. For many of the natives at Standing Rock, the idea of global insurrection was an appealing remedy to the abuses of state and corporation. There was nothing new about the sentiment. Few groups embrace insurrection more eagerly than Palestinians, who arrived at the Sacred Stone Camp in large numbers. And before going further, I'd like to complicate our understanding of the Palestinian presence in North Dakota, and this is going to build off of Rabbi Rosen's very germane comments in his overly generous introduction. We should distinguish between Palestinians in the U.S. and Canada and those from the Arab world. The Palestinian youth movement and other groups in Palestine sent delegations, which presents a slightly different political and logistical context than that attending to Palestinian Americans who made the journey as individuals or in conjunction with SJPs and other solidarity organizations. Those coming from Palestine had to cross at least three colonial frontiers, and as people exterior to the United States suggested the presence of foreign relations. More important, those coming from Palestine aren't implicated in settler colonization. Now, this point is bound to raise eyebrows, so let's spend a second with it. Non-native inhabitants of the U.S. and Canada can't all rightly be described as settlers. Those descended from the transatlantic slave trade don't fit the description, for example. And not everybody who occupies the category is on equal footing. It doesn't seem useful or very nice to pile too much responsibility for the sorry condition of the United States onto refugees and other displaced people. Plenty of Palestinians in North America arrived in such circumstances. There's also a semantic element to the discussion that would take a few days to sort out. What do we mean by settler, and so forth and so on. Let's therefore think about the category in terms of socio-political relationships. Of all the people in Sacred Stone Camp, only members of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation have a legitimate claim to the land. Other indigenous peoples can make the same claim to the lands from which they traveled. No matter what led everybody else to North America, they have no ownership over the continent. Who is a settler is a less relevant question than who is indigenous. The Palestinians in North Dakota then had a different relationship with their hosts depending on where they reside. And we'll leave aside the complicated relationship between diaspora and homeland Palestinians. Highlighting these distinctions may seem forced or overwrought, but it's critical to recognize the circumstances foregrounding our interactions, even if we have to force the issue. Optimally, such a recognition will produce relationships of trust rather than suspicion. The flip side to this point is how citizens of an indigenous nation regard their visitors. Any community involved in a battle for survival will welcome all the help it can get, but convergences create lots of stress. The solidarity, first of all, should be predicated on decolonization. That means identifying our own complicity in colonial structures and making a serious effort to extricate ourselves from them. Given that it is a thoroughly leftist concern, we shouldn't be surprised that Palestine has increasingly become an issue of interest to natives. Support for Israel unites all elements of the ruling class. Zionism is ubiquitous in sites of power. It is difficult being Palestinian in North America, because even the simplest articulation of ethnic or national identity is all but verboten in spaces governed by the laws of civility. Enacting any sort of personhood is an invitation to derision and recrimination. It is in many ways a life of absence, but one also afflicted by a constant fear of being exposed. Indian country is a place for Palestinians to be seen, and in Indian country, Palestinians see reflections of their own marginalization. I don't often agree with the internal reports of private mercenary firms, but Tiger Swan was wise to fret over the large number of Palestinians at Sacred Stone Camp. If natives and Palestinians continue to gather, it will indeed be a threatening development. Amid the U.S. government's amped up violence at Standing Rock late in 2016, a college student in the Gaza Strip, Isra Suleiman, decided to write a letter. Addressed, "Dear Native Americans," she declares, "When I read your history, I can see myself and my people reflected in yours. I feel in my core that your fight is my fight and that I'm not alone in the battle against injustice." And there's a strong basis for Suleiman's observation. The fight is mutual because the enemy is the same. Suleiman explores the emotional dimensions of being colonized. It's not something often discussed amid the strategizing and theorization of insurgent politics, but visceral feelings of community are a critical source of resistance. It is essential to transform those feelings into tangible bonds, if only to illuminate how political and economic classes function across cultures and hemispheres. Visceral reflexes in general are an important dimension of the revolutionary imagination. What we take to be instinct is in reality a manifestation of consciousness formed by incessant stimuli over long periods of time. Such manifestations offer terrific potential for intellectual growth. If something doesn't feel right, then articulate the ethical dilemmas it creates. If it feels natural to identify with the struggles of another group, historicize the circumstances that might justify the identification. The impetus for this feeling is knowing how the world works from the perspective of the fugitive, the alien, the derelict, the castaway excluded by capitalism's triumphalist narratives. People who apologize for corporate greed and ethnic cleansing don't experience the process, one reason why their sense of empathy is so stunted. Suleiman exquisitely captures the sentiment. I'm reading again from her piece. "Like yours, our resistance has been labeled as acts of terrorism and violence, rather than as a fight for survival and dignity. That's not surprising, since this is the policy of every oppressor who seeks to criminalize others to justify its acts. It is the oppressor's way to create its own version of reality, to rationalize its behavior and brainwash the masses. And it is the oppressor's plan to make the colonized feel weak and alone. But you are proving they won't succeed, and I want you to know that my people are with you." The oppressor's version of reality predominates in educational cultures and the information economy. Decolonization isn't simply a matter of expunging and occupying power, but of subverting the regimes of order it imposes on the world, of tearing away its masks of conquest, to use Gauri Viswanathan's memorable phrase, honoring our fear and anger, our joy and desire, verboten in the technocratic colony, isn't simply to articulate our humanity, but to summon a more human condition for those who will inherit the consequences of our decisions. Corporate media won't compare natives and Palestinians as Suleiman does. They prefer to invoke one group to justify the suffering of the other group. Writers and academics in both the U.S. and Israel acknowledge that settlers killed and displaced the people they encountered. They also say that the people the settlers encountered were exceptionally hostile and forced the settlers into regrettable violence. We all know the narratives. But those deeds, right, the killing and displacement, those deeds should be praised, though, because natives and Palestinians are barbaric, and anyway, all that bad stuff led to democracy. Purveyors of this view imagine that they are bartering eggshells for omelets. But the narrative they peddle doesn't justify ethnic cleansing. It implicates Western democracy in violence, suggesting that it would have been impossible as a peaceable development. And in this, they're correct. One such specimen is Israeli scholar Gerald Aronoff, who invokes native degeneracy to rationalize Israeli bloodshed. And I'm quoting from one of his essays. And this is a direct quote. I promise I'm not making it up. America had an Indian savage problem. Before July 4th, 1776, the day the USA declared its independence, savage Indians, history records, would sneak into homes of new immigrants from Europe and brutally stab to death sleeping men, women, and children who never did the least harm to the Indians. Unquote. Okay, this is standard issue conservative apologia, but it takes an interesting turn when Aronoff channels the spirit of Cotton Mather. History records that these Indians would boast of their heinous cruelties at night-long campfire celebrations. This was Amalek in America. The Amalek that attacked the Israelites after the Exodus were a true horror. The Indians attacked defenseless women and children without mercy and scalped their victims in battles. Anyone tempted to dismiss these passages as the ravings of a maladjusted demagogue should consider that the article is published on the website of a major Israeli TV station and derives from rhetoric long used by Israeli mythmakers. I won't argue against the point that Aronoff is maladjusted, though. It is but superficially different from its liberal counterparts, which more or less agree but are willing to admit that settlers killed natives. Take the following pronouncement. We today face a barbaric and cruel enemy, similar in its savagery to the one Benjamin Franklin faced. As with the Palestinian Arabs, there has been a politically correct romanticizing of American Indian culture, causing it to become acceptable to blame the white man for all their ills and play down their brutality. It's no accident that an Israeli like Aronoff so closely resembles a certain style of American writer. The distinctive fashion of language, style, and outlook bespeak robust ideological commerce between the two states. There's nothing random about reactionaries on both sides of the Atlantic sounding interchangeable. Aronoff, however, includes an interesting hedge near the end of his piece. The Jews are similar to the Indians as far as historic rights are concerned, but the Palestinian Arabs resemble the Indians in savagery. This bit of nuance, if you want to call it that, arises from... There's one good thing about the Indians, and that's what the Jews can claim. All the bad stuff, they're just like the Palestinians. But he's willing to grant natives a minuscule claim to belonging in North America, but the same magnanimity is unavailable to Palestinians. And this hedge suggests that instability exists in the unbreakable relationship between the United States and Israel. Unlike affinities grounded in the desire for justice, those based in realpolitik last only as long as treachery manages to serve both parties. In the end, messianic fantasies have no room for community. Individualism governs colonial states. Their alliances demand mutual profit. As unlikely as it seems, activists can disrupt those alliances by altering the market conditions of neoliberal commerce. We should, wherever possible, enact such disruptions. It's useful to remember that even the most aggressive peons to the special relationship, such as Aronoff's, can be undone by their own chauvinism. In the winter of 2018, Israeli Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, known for calling Palestinian children little snakes, warned of a, quote, creeping conquest from Africa. You've probably heard the quotes. They were broadcast everywhere. In seeking to keep Africans out of Israel and to expel those already there, Shaked argued, Israel is a Jewish state. It isn't a state of all its nations. That is, equal rights to all citizens, but not equal national rights. Her language strongly resonates with racial discourses across the ocean. Citizenship in the United States, as in any other nation state, isn't the neutral domain of law, although it pretends to be. It is a political and economic commodity apportioned and restricted according to the needs of capital. Immigration policy is a form of social engineering, and immigration policy in the USA has always favored people based on race, religion, class, ideology, ability, language, culture, geography, and influence. Those who brag about coming to the U.S. legally, as if it's solely a question of merit, are either deluded or dishonest. It's not a coincidence that just after U.S. officials eased racial, geographic, and religious quotas, they tightened immigration controls. Shaked's diction corresponds to that used by American ethno-nationalists. In Israel, Africans are creeping, just as Sharia is doing in Europe and North America. The verb, creeping, beloved of xenophobes, suggests that the presence of a foreign element is persistent and deliberate, almost imperceptible, covertly infiltrating credulous societies. Creeping implies sneakiness. It brings to mind ooze or slime, substances that assume the shape of whatever body they enter. This kind of behavior is undertaken by primordial enemies. Likewise with the word conquest, which evokes war and the violent defense of besieged homelands. See, Africans aren't in Israel merely to annoy the Jewish majority, but to subjugate the country's rightful owners. This sort of language can appeal to white supremacists in the USA who are perturbed that in some way or another, Africa is creeping into places it doesn't belong. As a result, we're seeing a peculiar confluence between certain narratives of Zionism and the alt-right. And Zionism has always been given to contradiction. Israeli leaders regularly express disdain for Palestinians, sometimes using crude terminology, like little snakes, but they also like to speak of their state as occupying a superior moral position in the world, a habit of U.S. politicians. Israel, they proclaim, is modern and democratic, and unlike its Arab neighbors, tolerant of minorities. Fewer people around the world believe these claims. Perception of Israel is increasingly negative, even in the United States. A January 2018 Pew Research Center poll found that only 27% of Democrats sympathize with Israel, as opposed to 79% of Republicans. This finding is similar to other surveys, noting that U.S. liberals increasingly disidentify with Israel. The contradiction between the ideals and practices of Zionism is unresolvable because violence is baked into the ideology, one reason why it has always inspired dissent among Jewish philosophers and religious figures. When those purporting to oppose racism also support apportionment of rights based on ethnic or religious identity, it is less an act of personal hypocrisy, though it's that, than an encounter with the fundamental contradictions of modernity. in addition to chattel slavery, which consecrated a racial logic still in use today, fables of settlement would come to play a defining role in the American self-image. As ridiculous as it seems for an Israeli politician to laud democratic values while at the same time preaching the necessity of ethnic cleansing, doing so follows a distinct rationale comprising the state's philosophical and legal foundation. The commitment to democracy is sincere. It happens to be inclusive only of people born to belong, however. U.S. democracy, too, is based on legal exclusions, which supply nostalgia for the alt-right activists who covet a return to better times, when the body politic wasn't diluted by foreign agents. That the state continues to exclude various classes of the disenfranchised is little consolation. White nationalists demand something more concrete than de facto iniquity. The problem doesn't end with white nationalists, though. White supremacy is the frame of reference for commonsensical policing and jurisprudence. It furnishes the assumptions that guide legislation and public debate. Anyway, so long as people continue to uphold myths of whiteness, neo-Nazism will find recruits and sympathizers, and institutions that feign progressivism will continue to tolerate it. North American and European states will always have a magnetic attraction to racial supremacy until national identities are disinvested of their colonial inheritance. Nazism is the id of civility. Palestine occupies a critical intersection of domestic and imperial violence. Native hardship foregrounds Palestinian suffering, which both derives from and informs the subjugation of black people in the United States. Black and Native internationalists raised this point decades ago, and it only becomes ever more immediate. Arguments persist on the U.S. left about whether it's better to prioritize race or class, often at the expense of gender, sexuality, and imperialism. Wise commentators have illustrated how any serious revolutionary politics should integrate categories of oppression. It's a tough task to summarize the debates and their recommendations, so I'll only add an observation that isn't meant to be as flippant as it will probably sound. People want to destroy oppression for different reasons. It's useful to work with anybody serious about its destruction. Any left formation that asks the subjected and disenfranchised to patiently wait out a series of reforms undertaken by a singular class of influential mediators, no matter how reasonable it sounds, is doing the work of colonization, and itself ought to be destroyed. Thank you. Well, thank you for your question. And the gentleman asked if I could parse or sort of elaborate on that line about Nazism being the id of civility. I'm probably going to break my promise not to talk too much. So, please just flag me down if I start wandering. I guess, that's a heavy comment because it's using heavy terminologies. And that line is coming out of a book I have coming out with Haymarket in the winter or spring of next year. And it's called We Could Be Free, Palestine in the Revolutionary Imagination. I elaborate on the idea in the book, and I'll try to give you a decent summary of it here. The idea is that in societies that are predicated on forms of racial superiority that get consecrated by the state, that have been critical to the very development of the society itself, and the United States, of course, meets those criteria. Think about all the ways in which racism, anti-black racism particularly, defines our day-to-day lives in ways that we don't even notice. Redlining, right? Automobile culture, the development of the suburbs, Racism is directly implicated in all of them, right? So the fact that we have, like, I live outside of D.C. now, and it's this huge, sprawling metropolis now. D.C. itself is tiny, right? But its surroundings in Maryland and Virginia keep going and going and going. I know because I have to drive in that nonsense every day, right? And one of the reasons is because of automobile culture and because of black people in D.C. and white flight. And so this is a way, when I'm sitting in traffic on the Beltway, you know, cursing and being angry and being prickly, right? This is one way in which racism has actually played a direct role, right, in the development of this kind of infrastructure, right? And we don't even know it. We don't think about it. But when you apply the history to the way that our the various aspects of our society or our civilization have come into existence, you can't avoid it. Right? It actually conditions the way that we exist in our day-to-day lives, right? And we don't even notice it, but it's there. And so I'm saying that as long as there's this idea of a normative national identity, right, that's synonymous with whiteness, then a certain kind of racial politics is always going to appeal to people who identify with majoritarianism, especially as our resources become constricted, right? And then people see a material value, right, in identifying with a community that wields the most power in a multicultural society. So all of these things sort of go into the idea that Nazism is the id of civility, that is, until these societies, you know, in Eastern Europe, right, in the United States, but, you know, I'm thinking of Europe and North America particularly, until they get rid of the idea that there is a normative national identity that is predicated on a set of racial mythologies, we're always going to keep seeing a resurgence of neo-Nazism. There's no way to get rid of it altogether unless you get rid of the ideologies that inform, right, a particular practice of national identity. I don't know if I'm making sense, but that's it's there, and it's always going to bubble up. And there's always going to be a scapegoat as long as national identity can accommodate notions of fifth columnism. I just made it out up, right? But, you know, it's always going to be Jews to scapegoat, Muslims to scapegoat, black people to scapegoat, right? And as long as a rhetoric of belonging and patriotism puts forward the idea, the nostalgic, dangerously nostalgic idea that something pure is constantly being ruined, right? Then it's going to be simple to scapegoat those people, right? And so when we talk about, like, eliminating racism or stamping out these neo-Nazi threats, and this is something that brings, right, people of different religious backgrounds together, right? We all have a common enemy in the rise of the neo-Nazi right. When we talk about getting rid of it, we have to go deeper than just you know, shutting down their speaking engagements or whatever. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. These are good strategies. These are important. But, you know, it requires a deeper analysis. It requires a more profound reckoning with how it is that we've come to identify ourselves and be constituted within the national multi-ethnic fabric, so to speak. Yeah, I was asked to elaborate on sort of the interrelation between race and class in the United States and how it contributes to a particular capitalist dynamic in the United States and elsewhere. I'll try to limit to the United States because, you know, I've been interested in Palestine for years. I could say more than three decades now, ever since I was a kid. But I actually I'm much less familiar with the dynamics of race in Israel, just as I am with the dynamics of race in Palestine. There are dynamics of race there, right? In both places, right? And there's a lot of overlap in the dynamics of race. But in the United States, I would say that, you know, what we're seeing on the left, and increasingly in liberal sites of debate also, is I guess, it's something of a turf war. People are sort of arguing about whether we can eliminate racism by creating economic equality. And this is an argument that has been associated probably unfairly with certain elements of the Bernie Sanders campaign, although he himself never really said anything like that. But there's an idea that the rising tide will lift all boats. And then there was some opposition to this this iteration of social democratic politics from people saying, no, you can eliminate, or you can try to eliminate economic equality, but you can still have white supremacy. You need to eliminate white supremacy. That's the source of the problem. And so this is the very, very broad, crude outlines of the debate. But, you know, there's also been a lot of terrific work from people all over the political spectrum, actually, that note that in a U.S. context, you can't, in fact, at all separate racism from economic inequality, that one is an engine of the other, that the development of U.S. capitalistic wealth, right, is predicated on chattel slavery. It's predicated on the theft of resources from indigenous nations and so forth. And a lot of studies have been done in the past year that show shows just how much wealth was generated from the slave trade and how much that wealth is still concentrated in the same hands today, and the numbers are stunning. And if I had any kind of memory, I would recite them for you. But you can take my word for it, I guess, if you're willing to do that. As by way of answer, I'll go ahead and just editorialize and tell you where I stand on it. I have little use for rhetoric that attempts to downplay the seriousness and importance of white supremacy, structural racism, anti-black racism, you know, anti-Arab racism, anti-Semitism, etc., in the way that our society, our social functions, and our economic classes are constituted in this country. I think that it's a real intellectual problem when people try to minimize them, and I think it's also an ethical lapse when people try to minimize them. This isn't to say that you can wave your wand, you know, if you can solve racism, all of a sudden, you know, you can create a utopian society. No, but this is to say that if we want to understand the depths of the problems that would lead to a situation where somebody like Donald Trump can get elected president, right, then we have to confront these ugly, discomfiting realities, and we have to understand the ways in which we might be implicated in those realities, and the way that we can reproduce the problems either actively or by refusing to come to terms with the way dynamics of power function across both racial and economic lines. I'm rambling, but I'm also trying to give you a sense of sort of what's at stake in the debates and the arguments that, and I don't think that I don't have much use intellectually or ethically for narratives that minimize or refuse to take seriously the very real pain and trauma people of oppressed communities feel, that we have to honor that pain and we have to try to understand the trauma. We have to listen. We have to be empathetic. It's not cool to say, well, you know, what you're telling me about your family's history, about your experience, about what your day-to-day life is invalid because I don't recognize it, right? That's a really strong and powerful set of issues that you raise. And the gentleman asked me about sort of talking about sites of authority and how they influence our thinking and our decision making, and how we can kind of recognize that and push back against that. And it was something that I was thinking about actually as during the service this afternoon earlier today, and I got to attend about the last 50-60 minutes of it, and it was really wonderful. It was extraordinarily moving, and I kept thinking as folks kept reading the small stories about the of the dead, and as Rabbi Rosen was delivering his really moving lecture, that's exactly what I was thinking about. That when soldiers line up on the border fence of the Gaza Strip, and start shooting at protesters, right? Whether they're being violent or nonviolent. And again, we're looking at a very long process of parsing out the nuances of those definitions, right? But, you know, I think it's undeniable at this point that people are being shot, and they're being shot unjustly, and they're suffering tremendously as a result. Well, why in the world would anybody want to identify with the soldiers? That's a simple existential question. And I don't know if this is what the gentleman who asked the question is getting at, but that's what it puts me in mind of. But really, who identify? What would compel a human being to say, I'm on the side of the dude with the gun shooting at the protester who probably has $2 in his pocket, right? Who has suffered in ways that we can't even imagine. What compels us to do that? Okay, so there are probably a lot of psychological and ethical and narrative and rhetoric and educational factors that go into it, you know. So I'm not interested in working that out, but what I'm interested in is, well, who benefits when people are trained to identify with the man with the gun? Who benefits? The person identifying with the soldiers isn't benefiting unless that person is involved in the arms trade, right? But who benefits? Who benefits from this occupation? Who benefits from the violence that the IDF is visiting on the people of the Gaza Strip and the people of the West Bank, right? And then people inside Israel as well. Who's benefiting? Right? The elite political class is benefiting. Reactionary politicians like Netanyahu are benefiting, right? Arms traders, weapons manufacturers are benefiting. Those people who want to identify with that strong state, with the heavy hand, they're not getting anything out of it. They're getting a psychic benefit, a psychological benefit, right? But they're getting no material benefit from it. Right? And in fact, they're empowering the same people who consider them an inconvenience and who have no interest in making their lives better, who see them as a source of continuous exploitation. It's like people in the U.S. They keep voting for politicians who dispossess them, right? Because they get a psychic benefit out of identifying with the strong community, with the majoritarian community, right? Nazism, it's the id of civility, right? For belonging to something, for having access to something that from which other people are excluded. But it's a horrible inversion of the most basic human morality that nearly all of us, unless we're born psychopathic, possess, right, to identify with the soldier rather than the demonstrator. Right? And I think we should start there. Who benefits? Who's benefiting from Trump's border wall? Who's benefiting from banks that refuse to give loans to African Americans? Who's benefiting from immigrants and migrants being separated from their children and held in horrible conditions, right? Who's benefiting from that? The ruling class is benefiting from that. None of us is benefiting from it, whether we identify with it or not. You understand? And so it's this idea that sites of authority ought to condition our sense of purpose and our ethics, to me, is in the most basic sense, depraved. It corrupts the most simple, basic ability to be human and to feel empathy for people who suffer. But it's something that I'm always trying to ask myself, right? Or ask other people. That's why nobody wants to hang out with me. But it's so, you know, when I see a conflict, right? Even when I'm watching cartoons with my kid, I'm like, you know, shut up. You know, who's the aggrieved party in this conflict? Who is suffering in this conflict? Who stands to benefit from the fact that somebody is aggrieved in the first place? And these are simple, easy questions, and they always, almost always anyway, lead to simple, easy answers. Right? Unless we're conditioned to privilege the psychic benefits we might derive, right, from being told to identify with sites of power, as if that makes us superior human beings. You know, so I don't think that we should listen to sites of authority at all. That's a really long answer. So I was asked about the, you know, if perhaps there's some kind of human need to identify with sites of power. He described an argument with his sister where she just refused to listen to the kind of reason that we were putting forward, and that in the end she just said, you know what, I don't believe that that's happening. Right? So it goes from identification with power to denial. And I think that's a pretty typical trajectory for people. It's not a universal trajectory, but I think when you're arguing with somebody who supports Trump's policies at the border, or who support the West Bank settlements, or whatever the case may be, very often it ends up in denial, you know, that no, that's just not happening, or it's not happening the way we're saying. But I think another typical response is, and depending on the delicateness of the person with whom you're arguing, it doesn't always come out, but it's very often implied that, well, they deserve it. You know, that's what they got coming to them, either by virtue of some legal process. Well, they're not coming here legally, you know, or, you know, they don't meet the criteria for citizenship in the Jewish state. You know, what are we supposed to do with them, right? And it's a kind of pragmatism that is very ugly when you unpack it. I don't know if there's a human need. I try not to play armchair shrink too much. First of all, because I'm not very good at it, and second of all, I guess I like to keep our analysis as much as possible oriented in spaces of material politics. But I do think that, leaving aside whether any of these phenomena are innate to us as a human species or not, that there is a need of power to instill this identity in the very people that it exploits. That's where the need most distinctly exists, in those who have some influence on corporate media, on the system of propaganda, on creating narratives that benefit particular interests of the state and so forth. But if it's true that humans, or some humans anyway, are susceptible to narratives and discourses that allow them to prioritize feeling wanted over the brutalization of other human beings, then it seems to me that they would be just as susceptible to narratives that we should treat other human beings with dignity and respect. That it doesn't seem to me that there's anything absolute about so-called human nature that would compel us to be shit to one another. I don't know. I could be wrong. I don't know. There are probably brain scientists who are laughing on the inside right now at what I'm saying, or ethicists or philosophers. But I refuse to believe that there's anything about us as a species that makes us prone to treating one another horribly, that I like to focus on and emphasize the aspects of our humanity that prioritize cooperation and that prioritize mutual survival. And I go back to indigenous communities, you know, that before capitalism, you know, it wasn't Shangri-La, you know, everybody wasn't living a utopia, but these things that we're responding to also came out of particular historical processes, and those particular historical processes aren't necessarily universal.
Sure.
So he asked me what he called rightly a deceptively simple question, because and that's what makes a group indigenous. And one example, of course, would be the way that Jews and Palestinians sometimes fight over who's actually indigenous to the land, right? And of course, the idea of indigeneity in this case automatically implies or suggests, if not states outright, that the one group has a greater claim to the land than the other, right? So it's a loaded term. Well, because there are different ways to define indigenous. There are political definitions, there are legal definitions, there are cultural definitions, and there are rhetorical definitions. So I think we have to be careful about how we proceed. As pertains to the so-called Holy Land, I'm not generally moved by arguments that that would say Jews are indigenous or Palestinians are indigenous or Arabs are indigenous, for the simple reason that those claims rely on a dehistoricized version of the land's modern history. That is, Palestinian society on the eve of Zionism was not homogenous. Right? The population of the land in between the river and the sea, right, was not solely Muslim or Christian. It was not devoid of Jews. And so in this case, in the case of Palestine, I tend to think of those as indigenous, as people who had an origin in the land, who have a genealogy in the land, right, who have a claim to a space somewhere within the land, who have an identification with the land on the eve of Zionism, irrespective of religious identity. Right? And that to me is Palestine's indigenous population. That might be seen as a cultural definition. Right? The legal definition of what constitutes an indigenous person in Palestine is more complicated and it's more contested. But I know that the groups of Israelis, and I wish I had the reference offhand, because there's a really good article about it. Groups of Israelis over the years have petitioned the UN for identification as indigenous, and they always get rejected. And in fact, about 16 or 17 years ago, the Palestinians were named as indigenous according to the UN body that deals with indigenous communities. I forget what it's called. So according to international law, there's a particular claim of indigeneity that doesn't rely in any way on Zionism as the basis of indigeneity. The political definition of indigenous in this case, again, is something more contested. But I'm wary of any politics that tries to universalize and make exclusive a particular cultural or political claim. That is, I wouldn't want any sort of post-Zionist state emerging, if in fact it ever emerges, that banishes any kind of language, that banishes any kind of religious practice, and that banishes different versions of history to indoctrinate everybody into a particular version of where the state came from, if that makes any sense. So while the question of who is indigenous is deeply important, right, it can also veer into areas that enact our whatever impulses we might have towards ethno-nationalism. And in that sense, I think that it can be a little bit dangerous in terms of wanting to orient a particular people at the expense of the rights of another group. And I think that's the fatal moral flaw of Zionism, right? Or one of its fatal moral flaws. Now, in the United States, it's no less complex. In fact, in lots of ways, it's more complex, because notions of indigeneity or Indianness in the United States also come out of an American colonial legal system, and so you're dealing with a centuries-long history of jurisprudence that is exclusive from the rest of U.S. law. Right? Indian law is its own thing. Right, you know, it's its own body of law. It has its own histories, its own procedures, its own courts, etc. And then you're dealing with communities, many of whom had been severely harmed, that have been displaced, Some of them got taken to the brink of complete destruction, you know, and many of them have had resurgences since then. And so defining indigenous in these kinds of conditions can be remarkably difficult. But I think one thing nearly all American Indian Studies scholars will agree on are that notions of Indianness and notions of indigeneity have to be separated from a particular tradition of U.S. colonial eugenics that prioritize things like blood quantum, you know, that prioritize things like, as we're increasingly seeing, DNA tests and so forth. That notions of indigeneity have to have a more organic and communal presence. But your question is so deceptively simple because based on how anybody around the world will understand a term like indigenous, we'll understand it not simply as a cultural identity. We won't understand it simply as a historical identity. We're always going to understand it as a political claim as well. And that's really where the controversies come in, on the way that indigenous gets raised as a political claim, right? Or even as a moral claim to inhabitants. Okay, yeah. And that was a wonderful question about assimilation, and she invoked a Francis Fukuyama piece, to talk about an argument that he made that we need to have a unified national identity and what that means maybe for ethnic and racial minorities, African Americans particularly. Yeah, I didn't read the Fukuyama piece, and I try my best not to read anything that he writes. And if it was in the New York Times, I'm guessing it was in the New York Times. My wife has my login, and so like all my articles are always exhausted by the second day of the month. You know, I'll click on something on Facebook, and I'll be like, when did I read 10 New York Times articles? You know, and it wasn't me. Okay, but This is one of the most common liberal notions of identity in U.S. history. It goes back hundreds of years, the idea that we can have a unified national body and an identification as American that will supersede all the hyphens. Right? People are always complaining, or they used to be anyway, complaining about hyphens. Why do we got to have Arab Americans and Asian Americans? Why can't we just have Americans? Well, when everybody is treated as normatively American, then we can drop the hyphens, right? But don't tell me that you're not getting the whole bag full of imagery in your mind when somebody says American. And that imagery isn't white, male, and Christian. It just is. Right? This is something, look, my parents are immigrants, and you know, they weren't meaning to reproduce this idea. In fact, they were always sort of fighting against it. But when they described somebody as American, when I was growing up, I knew that they meant white. Do you know what I mean? Is he American? Do you know what I mean? That I meant, is he not an Arab? Do you know what I mean? Or more particularly, is he white? They never said, you know, American was never meant to describe a fellow Arab American or a fellow immigrant or a black person. It always meant white person. All right? And so these ideas run deep. And we reproduce them and recreate them in all kinds of ways. So assimilation can be a profoundly violent project. And when people insist on assimilation as a cure to some kind of social ill, very often they're unknowingly but still dabbling in a discourse that's tacitly genocidal. And that's the case for Native peoples, of course. Look, you know, we have a Jordanian origin on my dad's side and a Palestinian on my mom's. My mom is also from Nicaragua. And so in my line of the family, you know, let's say Arabic goes away, Spanish goes away, whatever. I don't know if it will or won't, but it looks like it will. Right? Okay. It kind of sucks, but, you know, there are also 350 million Arabs in the Arab world speaking Arabic. There are also 300 million people in Latin America speaking Spanish, you know, 70 million people in Spain speaking Spanish, right? The point is that the culture doesn't live and die, right, with my community, with my Arab American community, all right? with indigenous peoples, the culture lives and dies with them, right? There is no motherland. This is the motherland. Right? You can't tell people to assimilate. You can't tell people to quit practicing, right, the linguistic and religious and ceremonial things that make them distinct. And that's very true, I would argue, of African Americans as well. You can't create a nation state whose wealth is predicated, right, on systemic exploitation of a community that was wrested against its will, right, taken across the ocean, right, and used as slave labor for centuries and continues to be exploited, and then say, well, you can just drop all of these features that have comprised who you are and just become American. Right? At the very least, there needs to be a reckoning first. Right? There needs to be a truth and conciliation. There needs to be something. But you can't make that request, or you can't make that demand, because in making that request and demand, you're performing a tremendous violence on people. Right? I always think about, like the new atheists. I wrote about them way back, like in 2007, 2008. I'm proud to say I was one of the first who started disliking. I already forget their names. Sam Harris and the other one who said he likes church bells. Richard Dawkins, yeah. Harris and Dawkins and Hitchens. Like in my second or third book, I wrote a long piece about them. And I invoked the example of Jews and Muslims to talk about how their discourse is tacitly genocidal. Because Harris particularly keeps arguing, you can't raise children, right? You shouldn't raise, it's unethical to raise children with the ridiculous myth that they're Jewish, or the ridiculous myth that they're Muslim, right? Or Christian, right? But he uses Jewish particularly. And it's like, I don't know, look, I'm not religious, right? My mom is thrilled that today I was in a house of worship, right? You know what I mean? Like this is... this is the first time that's happened in a long time, really, like, she was so happy. I don't even care what house, just go to one, But I also belong to a particular community that I would consider indigenous Christian of the Holy Land, and that culture is important to me, that genealogy is important to me, right? And that I can still retain or maintain that identity without going to church. Just like you can maintain a Jewish identity without going to temple, right? One of the biggest cliches of modern Jewish fiction is the Jewish atheist, right? That you can be both atheist and Jewish. You can be Muslim without ever walking into a mosque. Because when you say that you can't raise your child with the delusion, that's the word he used, the delusion that they're Jewish or the delusion that they're Muslim, or the delusion that they're whatever, Diné or Cherokee religion, that you're actually asking them to identify with a structure of power and belonging that already exists. Right? You're not asking them to step into a neutral space. You're asking them to drop centuries of millennia in some cases, of identity and belonging and practice and ceremony, right? And stepping into this milquetoast majoritarianism, right? And you can't make that request because you're asking them not to. You're asking people not to exist anymore. And this is the problem, or one of the problems with assimilation, that we're not assimilating ever in a nation-state context into something neutral. We're assimilating into something that had marginalized us in the first place. Why would we need to assimilate if we weren't marginalized? So that's I'm very wary, and I think that we should all be wary of discourses of assimilation, but we should be especially wary in relation to natives. And by the way, it's just an interesting feature of U.S. history that probably still holds today, that the U.S. government, right, never wanted black people to assimilate, right? The one drop rule. They were looking to exclude people based on their blackness. But the policy was always driven vis-a-vis indigenous peoples on assimilation, a very violent, forced assimilation, right? And you could see that in Palestine, Israel, right? That the policy of the Israeli government is not to assimilate Palestinians, right? Not even the citizens, right? The policy is to minimize their presence as much as possible and to squeeze them the hell out of there, right? But nobody, as far as I know, maybe there is proposing a policy that we need to convert them to Judaism and turn them into us. No. Right, so it's interesting anyway, just as an aside, to think about in which ways policies of assimilation are considered useful by the state and in which ways that policies of assimilation are very much avoided. He asked me about sort of the idea of a unitary secular state in Palestine, and particularly in context of Israel's new nation state law. First of all, that the nation state law comes directly out of that quote that I had read from Shaked about that we can have you can be citizens with rights, but you can't have equal national rights. And that's a really interesting distinction. I know, because it's Shaked, that our first impulse is just to laugh off whatever she says, right, as being ridiculous or over the top. But the distinction she makes between, I think somebody could write a really, really interesting paper on the distinction she makes between the rights of citizens and national rights, because that goes at the heart of what the nation state law is trying to do. And Israel is probably the only state, I know that in one of David Grossman's books, he gets into a huge argument with Anton Shamas, the Palestinian-Israeli novelist. I think he's at the University of Michigan now, or he was a few years ago, about whether you get Israeli citizenship or whether you get Israeli nationality. And I remember Shamas arguing that, no, you get, you know, if you're Jewish, you get nationality. Everybody else gets citizenship, right? And on the U.S. passport, it'll say nationality, American, not citizenship. And it turned out that Shamas was correct. I don't know if that still holds. But anyway, it's an interesting distinction in terms of developing a legal framework of exclusion that also manages to speak to typical secular humanistic notions of equality. It's trying to do both things at the same time. It doesn't quite succeed, but that's what the nation state law is trying to do. It's trying to say that Jews have priority to this land, they have priority to the legal system, etc. But we are not, at the same time, a nation that discriminates, right? And it's you know, like I said, it would be a really, really interesting paper to write, and it probably requires somebody with a smarter legal and analytical mind than mine. Now, in terms of the unitary secular state, people have different ideas of what the optimal solution will look like in Palestine, Israel. But for me, that's I find it attractive, and it's one that I guess that most most writers and activists will find attractive. The idea of a secular democratic state where religious identity doesn't determine immigration policy or citizenship. Of course, people dismiss that as pie in the sky and as an impossibility. To which I say, yeah, it might be, but that's no reason to push it aside as something to aspire to, right? That you always want to, when you're thinking of a political vision, you always want to create the best optimal outcome and then work from there, all right? Why cut yourself off at the beginning, right? Why defer to the needs and wants and desires of power at the outset, right? You always try for the best. What would the best-looking society be? What would be the fairest, most just society look like? And to me, something along those lines would be it. I don't know. I mean, increasingly, the Palestinian population has warmed up. I mean, the population in Palestine, in the West Bank and Gaza Strip particularly, has very much warmed up to the one-state idea. It's an idea that really, for the past 10, 12 years, has sort of taken over Palestinian intellectual discourse. You know, it's kind of the de facto, like, even, you know, somebody like Norman Finkelstein, supporting the two-state is like now controversial, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, this is something that people argue with him about all the time, and that's just kind of where the mood of the Palestine solidarity movement is right now. It's very much thinking about unitary secular state, but it's also an idea that's really taken hold in Palestine. And it's an idea, interestingly, that has taken hold among, in a different way, among the Israeli right. You know, the idea that we've already oversettled this territory, right? And so what we need to do is create a singular unitary state that is under the control, that is under Israel's control, right? And that builds off of the idea of the nation state law to create tiers of citizenship and belonging. It's also become a warning among certain liberal progressive Israeli politicians that, you know, if we don't stop the settlements, we're screwed. We're getting a one state, and there's nothing we can do about it, right? And so there are different ways in which that the idea sort of gets processed through various discourses and rhetorics and political communities. But to me, the optimal outcome is one in which nobody is formally marginalized by the state. This is the optimal outcome for any national community, by the way, and nation states pretty much make it impossible, right? But I think of Palestine and Israel in terms of the outcome of a national community, not a state. I'd like to think of them as sharing a nationality, and not just sharing Jews and Palestinians, and Jews and Arabs, sharing a nationality, not just a citizenship. But it's one in which also that not only is our religious identity not a crucial feature of access and belonging, but our religious identity isn't identified by the state itself and recorded by the state. You know, this is an aspect, I think, of the Israeli state that people don't think about as much as they should. They think about the ethical problems of what it is to privilege Jews over non-Jews in terms of immigration and citizenship and movement and et cetera, et cetera. But it's like, well, what about the problem of the state getting to define the religious identity of its citizens in the first place, right? And do we really want to confer that kind of authority to people with a military, right? So at this point here in 2018, it's impossible to know what's going to happen. I'm not a prognosticator, but I cannot in any way visualize a workable two-state solution that would... I could visualize one being implemented, but I can't visualize one that creates any sort of closure to the issue or the conflict or whatever you want to call it. In other words, that, you know, Israel removed the settlers from Gaza, you know, last decade, but, you know, the problem of Gaza got worse, right? You know, so even if they impose some crappy little Bantustan-style state in the West Bank, you know, you still have the refugees. They're not giving up their rights, period, right? You still have the people who are living in those Bantustans who don't have proper movement, whose lives are controlled by what they imagine rightly to be an occupying force, and so it doesn't make the problems go away. Yeah, can I ask you what you mean? What would it mean in the United States, like in terms? Okay, and so she asked about what a right of return or something comparable would look like in the political geography of the United States. Right of return, first of all, and this is a phrase that we associate with Palestine, right? But if we can kind of extrapolate, right, and apply it to the landscape of North America, it requires, first of all, a land to return to. And so we cannot separate a concept of an indigenous return to ancestral lands on the North American continent if those lands, or at least significant portions of them, aren't under the control of indigenous peoples as nations. Right? The nations have to exist for people to return to them. Right? Well, they don't have to, but that's obviously the most viable possibility. So I would think of notions of return in North America also being coterminous with notions and practices of sovereignty and nationalism and projects for the reclamation of ancestral lands. And those projects are being done all over North America, some with more success than others. But, the Oneida up in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Oneida, are undertaking a project to, and my friend Doug Keel, who might be here, I don't think he's here, but he teaches at Northwestern in American Indian Studies, has done a lot of work on the way that the tribe is collectively going about repurchasing its reservation lands, right? And so there are ways in which right of return is attempted through the legal mechanism of repurchasing land that had already been sold after it was broken up after the Allotment Act. But in terms of people already occupying ancestral native land, I guess in the end it's the decision and the prerogative of that native nation, right, to what extent they want to accommodate the presence of settlers, and how they want to accommodate the presence of settlers, and what kind of national economy that they would want to create, again, optimally, right? But we always think of outcomes in terms of what's optimal and not what's considered minimal. So in other words, the moral and political imperatives of Palestinian right of return match quite well with the moral and political imperatives of native rehabilitation of ancestral lands in North America, although the legal imperatives differ quite significantly. And thank you very much again for coming. I've enjoyed it. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, so.
Steve, thank you so much. I just